Adam.
And hello, everyone.
Hello, everyone. And I was just going to wish you, Adam, particularly a happy June.
Thank you. I'm so happy you did, because it's June.
Sure is.
And first of all, congratulations to the rising residents, the rising fellows. I'm getting to me.
I don't want to talk about me first. Saving the best for last.
And all of those who are finishing training, such as myself, who will no longer be in training.
Dr. Adam Winters, attending physician.
A few short weeks. And amazing. I just finished my last weekend.
Congrats.
On call as a trainee.
You said it was a great time.
I had a good time. Saw a lot of interesting pathology. Did a scope. Just wonderful.
Okay.
How was your weekend?
Oh, mine was great. I wasn't working. But I am very much looking forward to soon replacing you as one of the four transplant hepatology fellows at the Mount Sinai Hospital. And I will be working July 4th weekend. So soon I will know the love that you have for weekends.
There will be fireworks going off in more than one way.
Perfect.
And I think for the listeners who are trying to put this together, Alex is stepping into my role.
That's correct.
As transplant hepatology fellow at Mount Sinai next year.
Yes.
Following in my footsteps.
Which means that you need a role. So what will you be doing next year?
So I will be staying on as faculty at Mount Sinai next year.
That's right.
Meaning that I will be Alex's attending next year.
That's right. And as of the July episode, our listeners will notice that when we say hello at the beginning of the podcast, I will be saying Dr. Winters instead of Adam.
That's right. And that's the kind of respect I expect.
Absolutely.
Over the next year.
Well, congratulations. And I'm glad
we'll
both be in the same city and in the same hospital.
Me too. Once again. Yeah.
So in terms of our episode today.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yes. So we have Dr. Sonali Paul on to talk about a variety of different papers that she's written and initiatives regarding increased inclusivity for LGBTQI plus patients. And I think it's a great episode. I think it has a lot of tangible information that we can use and sort of strategies that all of us can take to create a more inclusive work environment for our colleagues, as well as make a much more inclusive environment for our patients.
And she also mentioned some important areas of opportunity for people who are interested in getting involved through professional societies and other avenues throughout the episode. So I think it was a great interview.
Yeah, the last thing I'll mention is, as some of the allusions in the interview will suggest, this was actually recorded in May prior to DDW, but everything she says is very much still relevant. We just recorded for a change early and had exactly one episode in the bank. But we also wanted it to come out in June. During Pride Month,
right.
And
yes.
We have achieved that. But without further ado, our great interview with Dr. Sonali Paul.
Our guest is Dr. Sonali Paul, a transplant hepatologist at the University of Chicago. She has written about the challenges and disparities experienced by LGBTQI plus patients and providers in GI and hepatology, and we are thrilled to welcome her to Liver Talks. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. So we like to start our interviews out, if you don't mind, by just asking you to describe the scope of your current practice and how it is you came to be interested in liver disease and transplant.
Yeah, so I'm a hepatologist, as you mentioned, at the University of Chicago. So I did actually all my training in Boston, and then moved about my first job out of fellowship about 5.5-6 years ago. So I actually knew I wanted to be a hepatologist when I was a med student at Tufts. We had an inpatient liver service, and at that time Tufts did transplants. And I met my first patient, Mr. H, and did all of his paras for like the 4 weeks on service, and just like got to know him, got to know his family, got to kind of be like see how humbling liver disease is and just all of the physical manifestations. And like he was on the transplant list and he didn't make it. And I kind of just saw kind of how devastating that could be, but also how kind of comforting it was to like get to know the family and comfort them through that time. So it was very much kind of just solidified. And so I'm one of those people that just had to do GI just to get the hepatology. Yep. And so there's, I think, a good number of us out there. And so,
you mean you didn't find something love about functional bowel disorder while you were in fellowship?
You know, it's good, but you know, I'd rather have the sick meld of 40, you know, bleeding out of every orifice and take care of those folks. So, and so right now, I do transplant hepatology. My clinical niche is actually within non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And so I actually approach it from an obesity medicine perspective. I actually got board certified in obesity medicine as well. Oh, cool. So I do it kind of from a lifestyle, weight management, use a lot of the anti-obesity medications that ironically are also being used and not so surprisingly also in fatty liver. So it's kind of the scope of my practice. And then in addition to, you know, teaching and at the med school and the fellows.
Awesome. So we'll need to have you back for a discussion of fatty liver disease and the treatment of obesity. But sure. Today we are mainly hoping to talk to you about your experiences in healthcare, both as a provider and a patient, and a couple of the very impactful papers you've written describing care for LGBTQI plus patients. In order to have everybody starting from the same place, we were hoping that we could first define a couple of different terms so that we're all on the same page. So first, what are and then what are the differences between sex, gender, sexual orientation, and gender identity?
Yeah, so great question. So sex is kind of what you are born at birth, what the medical community labels you at birth. So this is chromosomes, you know, XY, YY, or XX, XY, genes, genetics. Gender identity is really kind of more how you identify yourself and see yourself. And gender expression is really how you want to display your gender. And so those are, and what was the other you asked me? If you
Sexual orientation.
So sexual orientation is the way we are emotionally, physically, or sexually attracted to another person. And so those are really more under the spectrum of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, or intersex. But the only kind of caveat to that is transgender is an umbrella term for people whose gender identity and kind of expression is different from their cultural expectations. So it's not specifically a sexual orientation because they also may identify as straight, gay, lesbian, or bisexual.
Got it. And you already alluded to this, but we'll be using the term throughout the rest of the interview and in your papers. It's also used and defined quite helpfully, but LGBTQI plus. And so we are hoping that we might be able to just go through the constituents of that and define them.
Yeah, absolutely. And so first thing I'll say is the terminology that we all use is very different. People use different types of words. And LGBTQI plus is one kind of grouping that people say. Queer is kind of another, which is in LGBTQ. And then sexual and gender minority is kind of another grouping. So it's very fluid. And that's what makes some of this a bit more challenging because and it's fluid in the terms of like what I say now may not be true, you know, 2 weeks from now or a month from now. And so it is very challenging to kind of get it down. But in terms of LGBTQI plus, and so the L is for lesbian. So a lesbian is emotionally attracted or sexually attracted to other women. So it's usually kind of for women. Gay is a person who's emotionally attracted to members of the same gender. But what's important here is that although we usually associate it with men, some women and non-binary people might identify as gay. So I actually identify as a gay woman. And then bisexual is a person who's attracted to more than one sex, gender, or gender identity. And then transgender is the umbrella term that I mentioned. And then queer was actually previously used as a slur. But queer has really been reclaimed by the community, specifically kind of younger sexual and gender minorities, and really expresses kind of the spectrum of identities. And then intersex are people born with differences in their biological sex traits that can include chromosomes, reproductive anatomy, and hormone production. And then plus is really kind of somewhat like queer, kind of other sexual identities not listed, like asexual, non-binary, gender fluid, pansexual, and like a ton more. So the plus is really meant to be inclusive as possible.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. So I wanted to ask you about the great piece you wrote for the Red Journal last year in their How I Approach It section. It's called Overcoming Challenges and Mitigating the Disparities in Our LGBTQI plus Patients. And we'll certainly leave a link to that article in our show notes. But you know, you start the article by relaying this anecdote about being with your wife after the birth of your son and this physician kind of badgering you about the location and the importance of your son's father. And it's this powerful moment where you as a physician are sort of like crossing over into this role as a patient. There's like elements of intersectionality there and are really experiencing the challenges faced by this, you know, the patients interacting with the healthcare system. And I found it, some of the statistics in your paper kind of startling, you know, reflecting the lack of training that providers in caring for this population, you know, are only getting a median of 5 hours throughout of training throughout medical school. You know, I think I would put the number of medical school training hours I had at maybe zero. And so unsurprisingly, you know, one survey found that 89% of transgender patients and 50% of LGB patients did not think there was enough enough trained providers to care for sexual minorities and that they would be refused care or receive substandard care. And so I'm curious if you could share your thoughts about, you know, why you feel our medical education system misses the mark on how to prepare physicians to treat this community and maybe some ways that you think we can begin to move in the right direction.
Yeah, it's a great question. So, I mean, it's kind of unclear why kind of medicine is so heteronormative and things like this somewhat aren't taught. I think a few things, you know, I think when we read about this and kind of the theories surrounding it, and so for the large majority, sexual and gender minority populations have largely been invisible. And it's just because they're much smaller, if you think about compared to like the relative general population. Although I have to say that's probably not as true yet, or now rather. In 2021, I think the Gallup poll came out and 20% of Gen Z actually identifies as LGBTQ. So clearly we're not going to be small any for a large part, but like moving forward. I think the other thing is that a lot of the focus in LGBTQ health and health disparities has really focused on sexually transmitted infections and HIV and the AIDS pandemic back in the 1980s, really focusing on kind of gay men and men who have sex with men. So I think it really neglected, and not that obviously that was obviously very, very important, but I think so much of the focus went on that it neglected some of the other kind of health issues that affects the community. And then, of course, there's always negative societal attitudes towards SGMs and sexual gender minorities. So I think this has kind of resulted in these gaps in our understanding and response to a lot of these health problems. And so I think medicine is just trying to catch up. And I think we are. I mean, I think as we see kind of society accepting this more, we're starting to see some of the changes happening in medicine as well. You know, some fields are better at it than others. But I mean, just the other day, I saw something, I think it was in the Annals of Surgery that just came out. Don't quote me on the journal, but something that just was published about how to be more inclusive for LGBTQ trainees in surgery. And so I think we're seeing more and more little things popping up, especially in specialties that may not have been perceived by you know, gay trainees to be as inclusive. And so I think, you know, it really though can't be at the graduate level training. It really has to start at the undergraduate. So, you know, 5 hours is certainly, even if it's the mean is 5 hours, that's certainly not enough to kind of focus on all of, not only the health disparities and just the unique kind of health challenges, but also to really understand the history of why, you know, LGBTQ populations may feel not as safe in medical environments, because there's this huge history of discrimination that's been entrenched in it. And so there's a lot of mistrust from the community into the medical community.
So do you think that there are initiatives, or are you sort of familiar with any initiatives that have been focused at maybe providers like the one you mentioned in your story who are, you know, who are out of practice for a number of years? Like, is there any sort of hope or intervention in terms of trying to reach people like that who probably are unconsciously sort of expressing or yeah, not expressing these, you know, this mindset?
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, Adam. I think part of it is that I do think it is, a lot of it is unconscious. I do not think people are trying to be malicious or trying to be exclusionary. I think it's just lack of kind of knowledge and awareness. And so there's nothing that I've seen kind of on a national level. There are organizations popping up doing things They're like podcasts. There's a podcast called Queer Diagnosis that are trying to do more education. But I think it really has to come from the hospital institution themselves. There has to be someone in leadership that recognizes this as an issue. And then there needs to be more education. So, you know, a really good opportunity for this to kind of for this education to happen is when, I don't know what EHRs you guys use, but we use Epic. And Epic has that functionality in it where you can actually capture sexual orientation and gender identity. But not every institution has it kind of turned on. And so we actually just started ours about a year ago. And so it was a great opportunity to start the conversation and the education that happens. And I think what has to happen, and we kind of alluded to this in the beginning, is that it's so fluid and it changes so often that the training has to be like an annual training, like we do our HIPAA annual trainings and sexual harassment annual trainings. Yeah. This also has to be kind of an annual, and it doesn't have to be long. I mean, it takes 10 minutes to kind of read up on kind of the newest language and terminology to use. But until we, you know, every institution kind of buys into that, nothing's going to really change. But the change is coming. I mean, at least at our medical school, just in the first year, there's at least 5 or 6 hours of LGBTQ health curriculum.
I find the med students I work with now, you know, I won't speak for Adam, but when we were learning to do like interviews, we certainly weren't asked or sort of taught to ask about pronouns and anything of that nature. But now every med student I've ever observed in the last like 3 or 4 years, one of their first questions is, what are your pronouns? And asking about identity and very inclusive terminology. And so I'm at least hopeful that the future generations are going to be much, much better. And then the question just becomes, how do we bring all the people that weren't necessarily trained that way up to speed, hopefully?
Yeah.
So you alluded to this a little before, and then you had a great article titled Embracing Many Rainbows, The Realities of Being a Gay Physician, Mother, and Patient, that there are a lot of residents, so people that are already in internal medicine, that may have been interested in GI or hepatology, but were hesitant to pursue a career in the field that we love because it didn't feel particularly welcoming to their identity and research interests. Do you have a sense as to why people feel that way about GI and hepatology and things we might be able to do to change that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And to be honest, when I first kind of, you know, when trainees first approached me about that and actually used words like tone deaf about our field, it made me incredibly, incredibly sad because I never felt, I mean, even though I identify as gay, you know, I never really thought about it. And maybe because in training, I was just kind of on autopilot and like had a kid and like, I couldn't think of anything else. And like, you know, it's just like, we're so busy. I kind of like, you know, sat down and thought about it and I was like, wow, they're like, they're really right because there's no representation. No one talks about it. You know, compared to, you know, the Society of General Internal Medicine, they have their meetings and they have pronoun badges, at registration. You know, I've never seen that at DDW or ASLD or ACG. And so, you know, it started to make me think that, like, if we can start having some more visibility and inclusivity to everything that we do. And so, you know, the Red Journal article, I think, started something. And so, you know, I think in June, I think we're starting to kind of celebrate Pride Month. The AJA did something with the diversity committee. At DDW next week on Monday, the AJA Diversity Symposium is all about LGBTQ health and how to kind of foster inclusivity and the specific diseases kind of related to digestive diseases that affect the LGBT community. So I think it's starting to happen. And I think as more and more people kind of come out, quote unquote, within GI and hepatology and feel more, I think that's going to draw, and as like the leadership comes out. I mean, I'm sure within all of our leadership, there is someone that identifies as LGBTQ. I just don't think they're openly out, right?
Sure.
And I've heard from people because like they're worried about their study sections and they're worried about their kind of own you know, career implications if they do come out. And I totally understand that because like you know, folks that are a little bit older than me, I mean, I can't even imagine what they've had to go through, what they've been through to kind of get to where they are. And society, it's slowly starting to change. So I feel much more comfortable being out. And I think as more and more people do that, as more and more people start studying these health disparities and bringing light to that. And I have to say, I mean, at the next ASLD and at the ACG this October, Yes, ACG this October, there will be pronoun badges.
Great.
We got those. DDW is very open to it. I suggested it a little too later, too late. So next year, DDW, there'll be pronoun badges. So I think, you know, the more people that kind of speak up, I think the better kind of perception we'll have, and more trainees will be inclined to come to the field.
Yeah, I think the pronoun badges is a great example of certain parts of medicine trying to sort of be much more proactive in being inclusive. Have you seen any specific fields within medicine that are particularly good role models as to how we could be more open and inclusive to LGBTQI plus trainees?
You know, yeah, I mean, it's a hard question to ask because I'm not too familiar with other kind of sections and other departments, but I can tell you that I feel like OBGYN, infectious disease, and general medicine tend to be a little bit more just integrated into it. And I think for, at least for infectious disease and OBGYN, a lot of like of what they do, especially the folks that do kind of gender affirming hormone therapy, it's the patient population that they see. And so I get it. And so a lot of people can argue, like, why does it really matter? Because, you know, if someone's gay, their IBD is probably going to be the same than someone who's not gay. But like, we don't know that, right? Like, because there's so many, like there's you know, societal things, there's stress, there's environmental things that potentially could, you know, have an impact. So my sense is that those are kind of the three specialties. But I have to say, I'm seeing more and more, especially kind of as, you know, I scroll Twitter, there's more and more kind of inclusivity happening in other specialties like orthopedics and vascular surgery and surgery in general. So I think that, you know, more and more people are talking about it, which is great.
That is great. And then what's your advice to LGBTQI plus trainees that are interested in GI and or hepatology, but have these doubts, have had these experiences with people within the field?
Yeah, so I think it's just trying to find someone that you can talk to. And I have to say, I mean, I think, you know, most people that write about this or are going to be presenting about it at meetings and conferences are very open to being contacted. And so, yeah, I have to say, after I wrote that article in the Red Journal, I've had, you know, many, many trainees contact me. And we actually started, it's being launched. Kind of a group. It's a group. It's going to be a nonprofit eventually, but it's Rainbows and Gastro. And so it's a multidisciplinary. It's not multidisciplinary. Well, yeah, I guess it is. It's GI hepatology, but it's also for trainees. It's for trainees, and then in addition to attending faculty. And our mission statement is CHARM, so community healing advocacy, research, and mentorship.
Great.
And so we're going to be having our kind of our first informal get together at DDW just to kind of meet up and then eventually break out into groups where we can, you know, do research projects and like multi-center research projects looking at populations like this. At LGBTQ populations with a specific health question in mind. And then I think, you know, mentorship. I think mentorship is so, so important for trainees. And even kind of, you know, peer mentorship for me, like having someone else that identifies as gay that is in either in hepatology or GI that I can bounce ideas off of and learn from. And so that's kind of the goal. And so I'm hoping as that launches and becomes something bigger, that'll also kind of draw in more trainees that, you know, potentially would be interested in GI and hepatology.
Yeah. And outside of the event at DDW, because some amount of trainees probably aren't going to be there necessarily, people that are interested in that, how can they find more information about that?
So eventually there'll be a website, but for now they can contact me and I can put them on our listserv. Trying to find nonprofit status, it's like a very cumbersome thing. So I'm working on that slowly, but eventually that'll be kind of the bigger goal. But they can certainly just email me.
Great.
So the last thing I think we wanted to talk to you about before we do our lightning round, is your participation in the AGA Diversity Committee. So I just wanted to hear, you know, your description of what the mission of the Diversity Committee is to start, and then hear maybe a little bit more about how people can get involved and some of the initiatives that they have.
Yeah, so the AGA Diversity Committee, it's there's a group of, on the committee itself, there's about 12 of us, and our mission is really to not only increase diversity within the GI workforce, but also address health disparities and increase awareness for our patients as well. And so there's a few different working groups. But the main things that, you know, kind of that we work on, there's a communications task force that every month will highlight different kind of, you know, specific months. So like for February, we did Black History Month. For March, I think March is Colon Cancer Awareness Month. And so, you know, for March, we had actually patient advocates that had colon cancer or some sort of GI issue. And then they kind of were like community champions talking about their own illnesses and how they overcame it and how they're, now they're advocates for the community. So there's that aspect. We also try and increase the amount of underrepresented minorities in medicine and how to get them through the pipeline. So there's high school programs that folks do that can that people can apply to. And then also having just like a speaker pool. So there's, you know, a bunch of underrepresented minorities in medicine and GI. We have a database of them, and then we, you know, we'll find, you can be, anyone can sign up actually to be in this database, and we'll actually tap them to do talks and things of that nature. So it's, you know, it's a great group. At, you know, to get involved every year, there's always, actually, I don't actually know if there's a trainee member, but every 2 years, people on the committee will rotate off, and so every year there's always call for nominations. I believe there's always a trainee member. I want to say that there is. And so you can always apply. I can't remember when the applications come across, but it's always a great way to get involved in any community or any society. And if you're interested in kind of how you can get more involved, you're more than happy to contact me or Ranke Ubadie, I think, is the chair of the committee.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll at least make a mention towards how to get in touch with you in the show notes for people who are interested in all these initiatives that we've covered. Alex, anything else you want to ask before we segue into?
No, I think we can say you've been very generous already with your time. So we can segue certainly to the lightning round. Whatever, okay. We got to give the people what they want.
Yeah, exactly. And we have to give Dr. Paul her afternoon back.
Yeah, that's right. Well. Yeah. You want to start us off, Adam?
Sure. The first question is, and we're just going to ask you, you know, some quick questions, and you just tell us the first thing that sort of pops into your mind.
Yeah.
The first
question, and we start the lightning round with the longest question that has no short answer. So just to get you in the right mind space.
Yeah. You'll notice that we're not in the top 10 of any sort of category on Apple Podcasts.
Yet.
So the first question is, can you define or think of a time in your training or career where luck played an integral role?
Luck. Wow. I don't know if it's luck, but I do have to say writing the piece for the Red Journal was a bit of luck. You know, I did actually through the ACG, I did the Young Physician Scholars Leadership Program. It's a phenomenal program to kind of train young leaders in the fields of GI and hepatology. And so I actually did that program during COVID. And so we weren't in person, but, you know, Mark Pochapin, who led it, did a lecture on leadership and courage and the importance of courage and vulnerability. And how kind of every good leader needs courage and vulnerability. And so, you know, I kind of, you know, you go to these lectures and you kind of like somewhat take away things, but that really struck home for me. And I remember kind of, you know, a month or two later thinking about, you know, I think I had had just another kind of serendipitously, just another negative experience with my son and my wife. And like someone thought my son, like my wife is, you know, my husband and like Raj's dad. And I was just kind of like, you know, this really has to stop. I just happened to email Dr. Pochapin, and I was like, and it wasn't even, it was kind of just like, I don't really expect him to maybe say yes to anything, but let me just try it. And was like, you know, we don't really talk about LGBTQ issues and GI. What do you think about writing something for the Red Journal? And he said he would talk to the editors, and that's how it kind of came about. So I don't know if it's, I mean, it, part of it's lucky because I don't know why I'm kind of, it just, I don't know what possessed me to kind of ask him to do that. And part of it, I think, was the Young Leaders Program and the lecture. But I feel like that alone, kind of that article alone, has kind of changed the trajectory of my career.
Yeah. I would count that as making your own luck, though. But nevertheless, a very valuable anecdote. And I think Adam and I can both second that the Young Physician Leadership Scholars Program is great, having both been through it. Yes. it could use a tighter name, but
it's very
other
hard
than
to
that,
remember.
Yes.
It's like YSPL.
There's some P's, some S's, yes, an L and a Y.
Yeah.
But people should definitely check it out because it's a great program. All right. So the second question, this one hopefully easier. What is the last TV show you watched?
The last TV show, Suspicion on Apple TV. So good.
Suspicion.
So good.
Tell us more. I haven't even heard about this one. I feel like I've seen everything.
It's like an 8-part series. And it's such a good cast, and it's about this group of like 4 or 5 people who were kind of accused of this murder, and but then they're in like in a different country, and there's like an assassin that comes and gets them. It's just so good. The last episode was like, the ending was like, meh, okay. Like he built it all up, and then it was kind of a letdown. But
didn't land the plane.
No, but it was so good. I highly recommend it.
Got it. I just finished Slow Horses this weekend, also on Apple Plus.
I don't know that one either. I don't know that one either, huh? I don't know that one.
That's like a British crime drama thriller with Gary Oldman and like all the British actors that are in all the shows. So recommend that as well. But Suspicion, we're putting it on the list.
And then our next one is one we ask everyone, which is, what is your favorite liver cell?
Yeah.
I think the Kupffer cell.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any defense of the Kupffer cell?
That's cool. No, it's the cleanup crew. Yeah.
It's the cleanup crew.
Shout out to the cleanup crew.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Dr. Sonali Paul, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you to Dr. Sonali Paul for a wonderful interview.
Mm-hmm.
And before we wrap up, I just want to say good luck to everyone who applied for a transplant hepatology position.
Good luck.
We hope that you find the program that's right for you and that you are happy with how the process went. I'm actually very curious to hear what people think about the new application system.
Yes. Good luck to everybody. Kudos again to ASLD and our very own Dr. Adam Winters for this initiative to create, I hopefully think, a much fairer and better system than the free-for-all that both of us existed in. The idea of getting to see all the programs feels like a luxury, and being able to go through it this way seems great. So good luck to everybody, and I can't wait to hear who my replacement will be in just one short 365-day stint.
That's right.
Well, on that note, shout out to Andy Coyle and all our other loyal listeners. Thank you guys for listening. Until next time, bye, Adam.
Bye, Alex.